Welcome to Software Gone Wild, a podcast focused on everything software-defined. I'm Ivan Pepelniak, and you can find me at ipspace.net, where I blog, do webinars, and publish podcasts like this. If you're a regular reader, then you know that I'm really skeptic about the capabilities of OpenFlow being used to run large-scale production networks. We know what Google did, and it was more or less building a rack-size router using OpenFlow internally. On the other hand, we know that there are people running internet-scale networks using OpenFlow, and one of them was willing to speak with me about his experience. Welcome, Nick Buraglio from...
the middle of Illinois in the U.S. I blog at forwardingplane.net, and I'm on Twitter at @Buraglio.
And you work for some academic institution, right?
Yes. My job is for a research and production network called the Energy Sciences Network. We're the service provider for the Department of Energy in the U.S., and you can find our information, our network map, and a lot of the cool things that we do at www.es.net.
Oh, that's what I see on your t-shirt right now.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So, a few weeks back, you started tweeting about this OpenFlow-based network that you built.
Yeah.
What was that all about?
Yeah, so I think a little bit of background context on, you know, where I built it and what the purpose of it was is probably going to be helpful. So every year there is an international supercomputing conference that's held, and it's just simply called supercomputing. And I've been involved in a volunteer group called Cynet since about 2003. And what we do is it's a very large group of extremely talented engineers that build, you know, they build the architecture, they build the physical infrastructure, they make it work, and then they tear it down. And what it is in this context is the what's arguably the fastest network in the world, all in the course of, you know, roughly a couple of months for this show. And I believe this year we had 1.6 terabits of WAN bandwidth coming in. I might be a little bit off on that number. It was a huge amount of 100 gig WAN interfaces. But my job this year was to build a production SDN network for the exhibitors to use as if it was their, you know, just their standard network for their booths and for their, you know, some of their experiments and displays and things like that. And so that's what I did.
So you build the show network like there is this Interop network that's running at Interop, only this was for a different conference.
Yeah, it's very much the same concept as the Interop network, with the notable difference that it's specifically built for like scientific experimentation, you know, people that are running like very large scale distributed visualization stuff, or they're doing, you know, wide area storage, interesting things with wide area storage. I mean, there's all kinds of really, really cool applications that happen over this network. But it's very much a big conference network.
So it's tons of bandwidth and probably a lot of east-west bandwidth within the network, plus a lot of stuff going in and out during the show, right?
Correct.
And how big is the network?
So it ranges in size. You can check out cynet.supercomputing.org, and you can see a picture of the what we call the NOC, which is a big stage of equipment that powers the majority of the core of that network. But you know, I can't remember the exact number of booth drops, but it's a fairly good size network. You know, they're distributed. We call them DNOCs, distributed POPs throughout the show, throughout the conference center, whichever conference center we happen to be in that year. The fiber is all laid. There's a, you know, surprisingly large amount of miles run of fiber specifically for the show inside any of these convention centers. But it's a, you know, it's a reasonably sized network. It's not small.
It's not two switches.
No. it's a very good sized network.
So you would, if I understand correctly, you would have like distributed points of presence around the conference center linked together with a core network or something like that.
Yes. And then in addition to that, there's also a significant DWDM element that's brought in to provision all of the WAN bandwidth. So it consists of a bunch of different teams, right, that all specialize in something. And each one of those teams has their deliverables. One of them is DWDM, there's routing, there's wireless, there's security, I mean, it's what you would think of when you think of like a big service provider network, in my opinion.
And you spent months building this stuff.
So the initial spin up, the staging of that is about a little over a week in October, and then you go home for, roughly 2 weeks, and then you go back to actually finalize it all, and you're there for about 2 weeks for setup, the show, and then tear down. And that's, but I mean, so I should also, mention that preparations for this come, they start like in January, and the show is in November. So it's a very serious amount of thought that goes into building all of these things out. There's a significant amount of planning, and a lot of very smart people spend a lot of time making this, thinking about how to make this what it needs to be, a year out. So it should also be mentioned that it's a heterogeneous network. So it also serves a double purpose of being a very interesting and high level, as well as, deep level interop test. So, you have different, I've seen, vendors ranging from Procket to, Arista, Marconi. I mean, because, this has been going on since the 90s, right? So the amount of vendors that come in and bring their stuff in and to have us, use it, it's very diverse. It's a fun time, for someone that's a, that's a network geek. It's sort of like it's very hard to describe. It's almost euphoric being able to sort of put this thing together and have all these extremely intelligent and, well experienced people to bounce ideas off of and things like that.
Just curious, how many vendors did you have this year in the network?
Oh boy, I knew you were going to ask me questions that I wasn't going to have the answer for. So from the layer, the networking perspective, if you take things like wireless and stuff out, because I didn't work on those teams, I know we had Juniper, Arista, Brocade. There might have been one more switch router vendor, and then there's all the optical vendors, Ciena. Oh, Ciena operated, I believe, at layer two as well. And then you have optical vendors, Ciena and Alcatel-Lucent and all of the main players. I don't actually remember all of them off the top of my head, but it's a very, very wide array of equipment vendors in there, and and we make them all work together.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's much easier today than it was, 10 years ago to do that kind of thing. But
Why?
I don't know. It just seems like, the things that used to be, I mean, you see these in any campus networks or any, wide area networks where you have like multicast may not operate the same on one platform as it does on another. IPv6 support may not be as complete on one vendor as it is on a more mature vendor. But most of that sort of worked itself out at this point from a traditional network protocol perspective. When you're looking at gear in the, the core networking slash core service provider level, that stuff has pretty much just worked itself out. You might see something like, ISIS may not be, you may have to fiddle with ISIS a little bit on, vendor X as opposed to vendor Y, but for the most part, it all sort of just works together.
So for all these years, you tried to get IPv6 and IP multicast running over the network as well.
No, we did. It was always running.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that was tough. Now I get it.
As a personal opinion, I am of the school of thought that interdomain multicast should probably go away. If you look at any core service provider, they're probably not going to have very many SAs within their multicast domain, but there are still applications that use it. Some satellite stuff that, you know, places like NASA are using, you know, it relies on multicast, and, you know, so we make it work. IPv6 is just, to me, you know, I won't be quiet about IPv6. It's one of the things that I think we should have had, you know, more than 15 years ago. But, you know, that being said, it didn't work out that way. But when I build networks personally, IPv6 is just another routed protocol that is going to be dual stacked and that you just have to have. And that's mostly the way it works, you know, with the context of this conference as well. You know, it's everything's dual stacked, and if the hosts support it, they use it, and if they don't, they don't.
And so, because everything was working so smoothly, you decided to throw SDN in the mix just to make it interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been doing OpenFlow stuff since about 2009, and, you know, it's been attempted in the past when it was very, you know, it was very green, very early stages in sandbox areas and stuff like that. And so, you know, I brought up last year, you know, let's talk about this. You know, what would it be like to do this? And, you know, what could we do with it if it actually worked? And so we had lots of discussions and decided we were going to try something, you know, with the expectation that it would transit production traffic. You know, me being the belt and suspenders type of person that I am, I wanted to have multiple backout plans in case it didn't function, or we ran into some esoteric problem, you know, that we didn't foresee. And everyone was in agreement that that was a good idea, because we do that with pretty much everything. And the other caveat was that myself and another guy named Paul Waifel, who works at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, which is just right down the road from me, we decided that we would try to build out a lab at his facility and just build it all first. That way we knew it would work. You know, we would have proof of concept. We would be able to move packets and make sure that, you know, when we went in, we had a pretty good level of confidence that it was going to just work. Now, you've built networks for a long time. I've built networks for a long time. We both know that the fabled trademark "just work" is fluff.
It never works.
It's never the case.
Yeah.
So, you know, we built proof of concept and we got it all working in the lab, and then, you know, we were blessed to, you know, okay, let's move forward with this. We ran into a couple of hangups, but
and then the customers broke it, right?
No, actually, the customers didn't even know the difference.
Okay.
They had no idea, which is, in my opinion, exactly the way a service provider network, or, you know, any network for that matter, should run. It should just be a thing that's there, and you don't need to think about it.
Totally agree.
And for the most part, that's the way the connectors saw it. You know, it was Cynet, it worked, it was fast, and if they had questions, we answered them.
So it wasn't the whole show network running on SDN. It was just a part of the network, right?
Yeah, we took a subsection of the network and ran it ran it on SDN, ran it with OpenFlow control, and it was roughly, I think, 70 drops, something like that. So I mean, it wasn't an insignificant number of connections, and it was a reasonably large amount of traffic flow, and we did some really cool statistics with SFlow, because all of the OpenFlow stuff that you can get for the most part will export SFlow. So we had some visualization of, you know, top hosts and top nodes and top interfaces and what the traffic was and things like that. It was pretty nice.
So how many switches did you? First, you said you had like 70 drops. That would be like 70. Edge ports on your network, right?
Correct. So I'm thinking about this like a, you know, my background is in service provider provisioning, and I did a pretty significant amount of time in my career at a very early regional broadband provider. So when I think of things like edge ports, I think of like homes, right? Here's your drop, here's your ONT or your DSL router, mm-hmm. or your cable bridge or whatever. So we had the distributed DNOX. There were a couple of those, a handful of those, and in each of those, there was a traditional switch and an SDN switch. And from those, we took roughly half of each of the 1 gig connected booths, and provisioned those with SDN up to the core network.
So you built like a parallel access network with OpenFlow.
Yeah, so we built a traditionally switched network, switched and routed network, and then we built an OpenFlow network, and they operated in parallel. That was one of our backout plans, was if for whatever reason we can't revert to traditional switching on whatever the OpenFlow devices are, we could just literally move the plugs. And so we had there's a really, really cool programmatic mechanism that has been custom built for this network that builds router configs and switch configs. So it builds interfaces, it builds VLAN tagging, it does all that stuff automatically, puts appropriate labels in there, and then those templates get they come from a template, they get built based on this database that exists, and then they get pushed out to the switches and routers. So that already existed, and we just added the SDN on top. We had SDN hooks into that database schema and set of tools so that we could, you know, add these SDN switches in there. But we also built the templates out for the switching so that we would have, you know, that was our tertiary backup. Our primary backup was we would disable OpenFlow because they're hybrid switches. We didn't use white box switches. We used Brocade ICXs. We could disable OpenFlow, and then they would just revert, you know, reboot them, and then they would revert to traditional switching at that point. So that was our primary backout plan. Our secondary, not tertiary, was we would physically move all the ports to the other boxes. There's a couple of days while people are building booths and moving things in where we can kind of tweak the network and make sure everything is on the level and up and up. And, you know, so we had time to sort of run down any kind of weird problems before there was people on it, with the exception of, you know, we built out test booths and we had Raspberry Pis hanging off of things and stuff so that we could simulate, you know, off of each DNOC. So we would provision the flows, and then we'd make sure we had full connectivity. And then when the people wanted to bring their connections up, we would just take our stuff out and they would have their normal fiber drop.
Just to clarify, when you talk about SDN, you talk about OpenFlow controller controlling these switches, right?
Yeah, that, in this case, yes.
Because what you described previously with the database and automatic configs and pushing down of configs to the switches, that's what I would call SDN.
Oh, it's absolutely SDN. And I've said that many times that, you know, we already have been doing this for a very long time.
Exactly. You just didn't know it was called SDN.
Yeah, just somebody named it. You know, when I was working at the University of Illinois, we had a very, very robust tool too, actually called Iris and Lens, and they were basically SDN. They used SNMP, you know, as their control protocol, but we could configure any number of the 50 plus thousand switch ports on the campus network from this interface. And we never had to expose, you know, customers to a CLI. We could just give them a login and here are the switches that they can have access to. So we've been, SDN's been around for a long time, just nobody marketized it, right?
Exactly.
Nobody commercialized it well, I guess.
Well, there was nothing to commercialize it. It worked.
Yeah, right. I mean, a lot of this stuff's just homegrown. So my opinion on OpenFlow is that, you know, it's simply a control protocol, right? It's not a silver bullet to solve all these problems. It's just a standard protocol that I can maybe replace SNMP with to do things that are specifically focused on controlling network devices and traffic flow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's still extremely green as far as I'm concerned. It's not because people aren't, you know, implementing it, but just simply because it's new, right? And I've actually had this discussion / argument with folks online that, you know, they'll say, well, it's not this, you know, it stinks and it's not stable and whatever. But, you know, I've been around long enough to remember when IPv6 was very unstable, when multicast didn't work on a huge number of platforms, when MPLS was still new, right? And there were lots of bugs in it, you know, and I think it needs more time. It needs more people to use it and say, look, this is broken. It doesn't work. Fix it.
Yeah. So coming back to your OpenFlow-based SDN, why did you decide to use OpenFlow? Why didn't you go with some other variant of SDN?
Specifically because it's quote unquote standardized. You know, it operates on multiple platforms. The spec is easy to read, and honestly, because that's what I have the most experience with. We did actually look at a couple of other options. I did not want to personally have a proprietary solution in there, because that's, to me, it's not as interesting.
Sure.
But you know, we did actually look at a couple, and one of them came very close to being, you know, what we chose. But we ended up with OpenFlow because, you know, in the academic and, you know, research and education networking, OpenFlow is still pretty popular. There's a lot of work being done on campuses and you know, regional networks, and with the NSF, the National Science Foundation grants that for the science DMZs and things like that. You know, there's a lot of interest in doing some more programmatic stuff in those areas too, like detecting elephant flows to shunt around into, you know, around security appliances and stuff. So OpenFlow is one of those protocols that's being heavily looked at to do those types of things. So that's more or less, you know, that's why we decided on that.
Yeah, for those types of things, it might be the right tool for the job.
Yeah. But specifically, I wanted to think about it from a service provider provisioning perspective because, you know, having worked at broadband provider, that's something that it's you either home grow it yourself or you pay for whatever vendor it is you're using for, like your PEDs, your BSLAMs or whatever, and you use their, you know, provisioning tools, which are usually A, expensive, or B, don't work very well, or they're missing things that you need them to do, right? Because they'll hit the 80%, right? Because it's commercial software. So they'll hit, here's the 80% of things that everybody needs, right? The 10% on either side of that, you know, is not deemed to be popular enough or asked for enough, requested enough to make it into those builds. Now, I will also admit that my experience with that is fairly dated. But having worked with a fiber to the home network when I was still at the University of Illinois, you know, customer provisioning on these pieces of equipment that we had was very clunky. It was very manual. And so I wanted to think about it from that perspective. Like, what could we do to make this, like, last mile provisioning easier, you know, and more easily controlled?
So you looked at this problem from the perspective of let's build a service provider access network.
That's the way I looked at it. Yes.
And now that we mentioned service providers, what services did you decide to offer?
So we kept it pretty simple. We did IPv4, IPv6, link layer, and VLAN flows. That was it. We didn't do any type of, you know, obscure traffic steering or anything like that. We did very simple last mile provisioning. And there was a couple of reasons for that. One, we were using OpenFlow 1.3, which I had not had a lot of experience in production with that. I mean, I've had it in my lab forever, but I wanted to actually push it out using OpenFlow 1.3, which, you know, is in the equipment and controller world is still pretty new, you know, in the grand scheme of things. And we also wanted to have the lowest level of potential confusion. So if you keep it really simple, you know, layer 2 VLAN tag, pushing and popping, IPv4, IPv6, and then you know, in addition to that, any link layer stuff that didn't happen to make it into the, you know, the VLAN tagging. We can talk a little bit more about that later. That was one of the gotchas I found.
Oh yeah, let's talk about that. So what was that all about?
Okay, so let me start this by saying one of the things I've been talking about forever is this whole network engineer is dead, long live the programmer. That may be true by the time I die, but today there is no way that a developer is going to build and provision a service provider network unless they have significant networking fundamentals. That just isn't going to happen. And
Okay.
the reason for that is that when you go to troubleshoot these networks because whatever code you've written is not doing exactly what you think it's going to do, you have to understand the underlying protocols, and more importantly, you have to understand how the equipment is interpreting those lower level protocols and how to look at it and decipher what it shows you. And so the first thing that we noticed was that provisioning of VLAN tagging, pushing and popping was, or stripping, I guess is the OpenFlow term, was working, but it was not working for link layer traffic. So
What do you mean by link layer traffic?
ARP, for example, right? A
What?
fundamental piece of networking, layer two, building the ARP tables, right? A lot of us take that for granted. I certainly did. I spent, 6 hours in the middle of the night trying to figure out why this thing wasn't doing what I thought it was doing. And what it came down to was the other guy that was working with me on this, we fired up a packet capture, straight up TCP dump, right? Or Wireshark, actually, in this case, to look at what was actually on the wire. And we had to learn how to decode that. We obviously already knew, but like anyone not familiar with looking at, packet analyzers is going to see things that they are have no idea what they
Yeah,
are,
line
right? And so
noise.
what yeah it's gibberish basically. So what Paul found it was that all traffic was being tagged except for the ARP traffic. So ARP traffic was either untagged or it was tagged with VLAN 4092 or something, which on this particular platform that we were using was the all ports reserved tag. And we never did figure out why some of it was tagged with that and some of it wasn't tagged at all. And frankly, we didn't care. We just wanted it to work. But
Was it the platform issue?
yeah, it was just a it was a versioning issue on the hardware we were running. So we did it was a known bug. We ended up doing a code upgrade, and then it all started to, it all started to function as we thought it would. But we spent almost 48 straight hours building and debugging and redebugging, and then working with people to figure out what was going on. We did. Yeah, so the other complication in this scenario of debugging was that, the controller is in the mix, right? So in a traditional network, you've got your control plane and your forwarding plane are in a box, right? You can't see the decoupling of those. I mean, it exists, but it's interconnected inside the devices. In an OpenFlow network, your control plane is completely decoupled and it's written in Java or Python. So we were also going down the path of, well, maybe the flows being pushed aren't doing exactly what we think they're doing, right? So you're also debugging this control channel that exists now outside of the network, for lack of any better way to describe it, that you didn't typically have to debug in the past, right? So in the past, you type a command on a piece of equipment and it does, that's parsed via the control plane inside the box and pushed into hardware or software, depending on your platform. But, with an SDN network and OpenFlow in particular, that exists outside of that. So you have this extra piece that you didn't normally have to debug in the past. And that, I think that's often overlooked. That's a significant chunk of knowledge you have to have and have to recognize when you build these things out. So we went through and we changed controllers out from ODL to the Brocade Viata or BSC, Brocade SDN controller. We changed back and forth just to sort. I mean, I realize they're the same code base, but we had tools that were already written for that. So we moved back and forth two or three times between those to sort of sanity check ourselves, and ended up deeming that that was not part of the problem. But that's a significant piece of data that has to be looked at that didn't have to be looked at, before the advent of OpenFlow controllers.
Yeah, so in traditional network, the switch would reply with an ARP reply or it wouldn't, right?
Yep.
And you might do some ARP debugging on the switch, and pretty soon you're done. And you either open a case with the vendor tech and say ARP is not working, or you try to play with the software releases, and eventually you get it done.
Right. In the past, I would have blamed the hosts, to be quite honest, because ARP is so fundamental that if the devices aren't doing ARP, the actual physical devices, if they're not doing ARP, then they're probably never going to make it out of QA. They shouldn't, right? But in the case of OpenFlow, there is no ARP on the switches.
Well, there probably is not much QA either.
Well, that's going to vary depending on, what you've got and what level of maturity it has, I guess, too.
Yeah, well, let's be polite and say that unit tests that they have for OpenFlow part of their code are significantly smaller, or the amount of unit tests is significantly smaller than the unit tests they have for traditional ARP.
Oh yeah, just by the nature of its age,
Yeah,
that's got to be
exactly.
true. Yeah, and that's not even vendor specific, right? That's across the board, right? Because it's brand new,
Absolutely.
in the terms of networking.
But coming back to your experience, effectively, instead of just saying, yeah, this switch is broken, or no, it couldn't be the switch because ARP was working before, now you had to troubleshoot the software on the switch and the control plane channel and the controller and maybe also your application, because if your programmer is playing with the ARP tables, who knows what he did wrong, right?
Right. And we'd had to do all of those things. And in addition to that, one of the things we were able to do, which was kind of nice, right, because it takes us back to this known state that we're all comfortable with, is we were using hybrid switches. So if we wanted to, we could just put them back in traditional networking mode and they would function as like a standard traditional switch. And we did that, just to verify, okay, yes, everything is working. All these hosts can talk to each other, ARP builds on each host, the VLANs are tagged, all the packets look correct, and then we can put it back in OpenFlow mode, right, which takes those things away. So that was actually extremely handy. And I've worked on equipment that is OpenFlow only, so that's not an option in that case for those. That was something that I think was important for us to have because we were under a time constraint, be able to just, okay, let's take it back to a known state that we're comfortable with, verify it works the way we know it should. And then once we have that data, then we can isolate, these other things over here. So it was a lot of very methodical troubleshooting had to happen.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. An average programmer has no chance of surviving in this environment for the first few years.
Yeah, I mean, until they have the experience of understanding not just what the protocols do, because they have to know that to write the code, but they also have to know how they're going to operate in the real world.
Yeah. And then you eventually hit an ARP request that crashes your code, like one of my ARP requests crashed Cisco IOS years ago.
Exactly. It's all about the edge cases,
Yeah.
right? Just like everything in networking.
By the way, speaking about the controller, why do you choose ODL and not, for example, ONOS if you were building a service provider network?
We actually tested a whole bunch of different controllers. Onos was on the list, but for what we wanted to do with it, we decided that the experience level with ODL and or Ryu was greater than Onos. Now Onos is something that I intend to spend significant time with at some point, in the near future. But just because we wanted to have something that we already had experience with, we looked at the BSC, the Brocade controller, which is essentially a commercialized version of OpenDaylight, as well as just standard ODL lithium build. And then we looked at Ryu, and then also Faucet, actually, which is, I think, a fork or an add-on to Ryu. And for what we did, ODL, it's what I like to call the Cisco 6500 of OpenFlow controllers, right? Does everything. And it was probably a little overkill for what we did with it. And we would have been, just as fine using Ryu because, it's Python, it's thin, it does what it does. But most of my experience is with ODL. And one of the guys that was helping us, one of the developers from Indiana University, he had written a very cool CLI for the REST API. So not only could we programmatically build these flows based on our templates, we could actually use his CLI to look at the OpenFlow switches as if they were traditional switches, sort of. So, you fire up his CLI, you do a git nodes, and all this is using the REST API on the back end, right? It grabs the nodes, you choose which one you want to look at. You go into that node, you can see the installed flows, the configured flows, you can see the ports, and you can delete flows. And then when you want to push flows, there's a separate application that does that because of the way we programmatically built the configs. But it allowed us to use his CLI to troubleshoot and look at the things in a way that was very comfortable for someone who's been doing traditional networking for 17 years.
So we hear all about CLI being the problem from a certain startup that I will not name. And now when you have a production version of the whole thing, the first thing you do is you build your own CLI?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, I'm all about like applications being able to do all these things and do whatever, but at the end of the day, I need to be able to troubleshoot it.
Yeah, right? Of course.
And I'm not a good developer, right? I can decipher some code, but I am not a developer by my primary function. So rather than having to look through code and decipher whether I think it's doing what it says it's doing, I want to see the hardware. Like I want to troubleshoot it as if it's a network because really that's what it is. And a CLI is what I'm comfortable with. And I think that that's one of the things that's probably missing out of a lot of the SDN hype is that there's this huge area, this huge population of people like you and me and 99% of the other network engineers out there that cut their teeth on a CLI. And when you're provisioning something and everything is hunky-dory, using programmatic methods is fantastic, right? It simplifies everything. It makes your life easy and, you know, sunshine and rainbows. But when it's on fire, you're going to revert back to what you know best. And for most of us, I think that's a CLI.
Well, it's not just what you know best, it's what works best.
That's a very, very good point.
Yeah, what would a sysadmin do in a similar situation?
Right, exactly. I mean, I know I'm not a Windows admin, right? I've been a Unix guy forever, but you know, I know a bunch of Windows guys, and when they run into problems with their Windows domain controllers or whatever they, you know, whatever they've got, most of them drop down and use like PowerShell tools because they don't trust the GUI. And there's good reason for that, right? It's thinner, it's less overhead, and the output is very straightforward. There's not a lot of clicking around. You don't have to remember like, oh, I got to click this before I click that kind of thing. It's very hierarchical, and the human brain does well with hierarchy.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned programming flows. Mm-hmm. So you were running VLANs, you were running layer 3 services. So I'm assuming that the controller was doing the routing functionality, right?
No. So we did only provisioning of last mile up to the routed point. There was a device, a core router, that actually handled all of the layer 3 routing functions.
And that was outside of your network?
It was a hybrid box. So it had open flow southbound and layer 3 traditional routing northbound to the rest of the core.
So why would you need to handle ARPs in the controller? I don't get that.
I didn't need to handle ARPs in the controller. I needed the controller to program the ARPs correctly into the switches,
which it
was doing.
So just the tagging wasn't working correctly.
Correct. It was actually a code bug on the provisioning equipment. The controller was doing exactly what it was supposed to be doing. There was no problems with the controller. And that was the only hiccup we ran into with the, you know, with the actual provisioning of the flows. And, you know, realistically speaking, it was pretty minor. You know, once we figured out what it was, we're like, oh yeah, that's not a big deal. You know, there's a fix for it. It's fixed. Now it just kind of works.
So you were providing point-to-point layer 2 connectivity across the access network towards the routed box.
Correct.
And did you rely on the baseline ODL functionality like dynamic MAC learning and dynamic flow setup, or did you program your own flows explicitly?
We programmed our own flows explicitly. We turned off everything that it – we wanted it to be as simple as possible, and so we turned down any sort of intelligence that, you know, was automatically happening, and we did everything programmatically based on our own flows.
Oh, so you effectively used ODL as REST to open flow converter.
Basically.
Yeah, that's an overkill for the job. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah. I agree. I had looked at another controller called Fawcett that was it was written by the guys at Rian's in New Zealand, and I really liked the simplicity of it, and it was very, it's very down to business. It's based on Ryu, I believe, and it was elegant, and I really gave heavy consideration to using that. Not only because it was simple and elegant, but because one of the Rian's guys was on the team, so I had somebody there that I could ask. But we ended up with ODL so that we could use the CLI, and because we had a little more familiarity with it.
And your application did all the heavy lifting, programming flows and everything.
It would build the templates for the flows. We ended up pushing those manually because of the troubleshooting that we wanted to be able to do. We wanted to see if we push one flow, it's okay. And then we push 50 flows. We wanted to be able to control the spigot, so to speak. We didn't want it just programmatically shoving a ton of flows in there because, frankly, we weren't quite sure how it would react. We did end up doing that at the end to just see like what happens if we just push everything all at once and it was fine. It didn't even notice.
That should work.
Yeah, I mean there was no, it was very uneventful.
Don't get me wrong, but from a distance, it looks like you reinvented frame relay.
Oh God, I knew you were going to say something about that. Yeah, I mean, so that's what a lot of SDN is, right? It's reinvention of things that are kind of already there. We could argue that a lot of the VLAN translation stuff and the layer two transiting that it offers is basically just a cheaper MPLS, VPLS
It
service.
is.
I mean, it totally is, right? But people that haven't worked in MPLS, which is a pretty serious amount of people in the networking industry because it's sort of specialized, they don't know that, right? And you can buy these less expensive pieces of equipment that can do these same functions as you used to have to spend, an arm and a leg for in the MPLS world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely true.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of it is just reinventing new things or reinventing old things in new ways. Which is, it's still interesting. And I think that, this proof of concept of, okay, the protocol is sound. It does what we say it's going to do. The hardware is solid. It accepts what the control plane is telling it and then does what it's supposed to do. I think that really speaks a little bit more than I thought it would, right? Because all these things kind of just worked. And now I can start to focus on what my real interest is. The software-defined exchange points, right, which do more than just layer two, right? They're exchanging prefixes, they're doing RPKI checks on the back end, and they're doing translation between protocols. Like I can do, this provider can allow me to do a VLAN path, and this provider can do VPLS, and then provider. This third provider over here, oh, it can do an OpenFlow provision path, and then they can all talk to each other based on this mutually understood software-defined exchange software that does all the middleware translation for it. I mean, that's where my research focus.
That definitely sounds interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's my research focus, right? I mean, that's the thing I want to see work. And, we've built proof of concept of this, and it does work. It's written in Perl, and it probably needs some TLC to make it more than just proof of concept. But, I think that proving the foundational pieces are key to actually moving forward and not wasting time.
Now, one other question that I still don't get exactly. So you build sort of static flows from templates using some service definition. How did you deal with core link failures?
These were all last mile circuits. So they were not redundant by nature.
So it was pure tree.
Yeah. I mean, so the core was totally redundant. Actually, that's not true. We did have, so the last mile circuits were not redundant because they were just the tail circuits, right? But all the switches were provisioned to multiple core routers. One of them was the SDN core, one of them was a traditional networked core. So in a failure scenario, we could fail over to traditional networking. So we had box failure redundancy. We also had protocol failure redundancy. But the box failure redundancy in this particular case was reliant on traditional networking protocols.
Yeah, so the open flow part of the whole thing was a tree.
Yes.
Now it all makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, if you see the diagram of it, it's very, very straightforward. And that was by design, right? Because we wanted to minimize any complications that we could run into
Yeah,
with this
sure.
sort of newish protocol. You know, one of the things this brought up is, you know, how do you deal with these things that we've sort of taken for granted in production networks, which is, you know, redundancy, box redundancy, control plane redundancy, control plane hardening, you know, and those kind of things that we either didn't have to think about or there were good mechanisms for. You know, how do you map that? How do you map SDN into that? And that's where it starts to get a little more gray.
Yeah, you have to reinvent all the wheels that we invented in the last 30 years.
Yep. You know, we solved the control plane hardening issue by, you know, essentially using a
By not having a control plane.
well, right, well, we had to have the connectivity from the controller into the, you know, into the devices, but we didn't want that in band, obviously, right?
Well, you had out-of-band control plane network and you didn't run any control plane protocols, right?
Basically, yeah. And so, you know, we built this out-of-band network and it ran over that and it was isolated, but that doesn't scale over a wide area network unless you're doing it like you're doing something like running it over an optical control channel or something like that, optical service control.
Well, don't worry, we had that before. It was called SONET.
Oh man, don't bring me back to that. It's too expensive. So yeah, I mean, these are all things that have to be thought about again. And redundancy is another one that's like you can do with VPLS, you know, you can build multiple paths, right? And so you can sort of do that with SDN as well if you're doing, you know, simple layer two stuff. But then what happens when you're doing like protocol steering and things like that? That becomes more complicated.
Yeah, and you can pre-configure the failure scenarios in the switches,
Yeah.
in which case you are yet again reinventing SONET.
Yeah. And these are the things that, you know, we have to really put a lot of thought into because a lot of the, you know, fiber in the ground, you know, it's built in ways that have been put in place to support traditional networking, right? Paths are, you know, plumbed in certain ways, you know, based on geography and proximity and things like that. And how does that change when you start doing all of these protocol steering things and or does it?
Yeah, I read this really interesting article by an academic. You know, he said, well, obviously we can't rely on centralized control plane over WAN network. And so we need multiple controllers and we need some shared database with eventual consistency between them.
That sounds like the route table.
Yeah, I was reading that and I went like, do you realize you reinvented OSPF?
You know, those are things that people, I mean, who's thinking about? I'm thinking about that. You're thinking about that. Who else is thinking about that? I keep coming back to using BGP for something, right? Because it works. It's very resilient. It's robust. And with things like flow spec, you know, RFC 5575, you can start shoving arbitrary things into those fields and do stuff with them if you're using a software platform to interpret it.
No, it also works on hardware platforms.
Right, yeah, I mean it does that too. I mean you can run middleware against it, I guess is what I'm saying, if you're
Yeah.
doing it on like ExaBGP or something.
Absolutely. Oh, you can do it on Open Daylight, by the way. It's a really nice REST to flow spec translator.
Really?
Yeah.
How did I miss that? Well, thanks. You've pretty much booked up my next weekend, I think.
Oh, yeah, you will share the results, right?
Of course.
Great, thank you. So, coming back to this proof of concept, how well does this thing work?
So once we got over the hurdles, which were actually shockingly few, you know, of this is something a little bit new and we haven't done it before, it just worked. Once it was up and running, you know, there was a flow change here and a flow change there, and that was pretty much it. It was rock solid. It just moved the data around. It didn't have any kind of weird hiccups or any type of packet loss or frame drop or anything like that. Didn't lose flows that were programmed into the devices. the state maintained between the controller and the switches. And, you know, we had not a single ticket open, if memory serves, about connectivity problems or anything on the OpenFlow Signal network.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, again, we built it in such a way that it was as uncomplicated as it could be so that we could accomplish that goal, and then we could study it later. So we could say, okay, now what can we add to it, you know, that we can still keep this level of stability and level of manageability, but also add a feature. But yeah, I was really happy with how well it worked.
Any gotchas beyond the ARP problem?
No, not really. I mean, I think the biggest takeaway for me wasn't that it worked and wasn't really that it had very few or no operational issues for the most part. Once it went in production, it was fine. It was that, you know, you can't do this without a very strong networking fundamental background. You won't be able to do it. It'll be a struggle. It will be difficult, and it will be, you know, in my opinion, overwhelming. Because if you don't have that background in understanding the fundamental protocols of, you know, IP networking and everything that it builds on to work, it's going to be very difficult to fix it if it does have problems.
So that just proves what I was always telling people. Take a network engineer, pair him with a programmer, and let them work together.
And frankly, that is exactly what we did. There were two network engineers, myself and another guy, and a developer who has a very strong networking background and a very strong SDN OpenFlow pedigree, and we made it work within that team
Awesome.
with almost no issue whatsoever. So,
Any other lessons learned?
know your controller and know your control plane path. You know, you don't want to, you know, some obvious things that people may not think about is you don't want your control plane to be in band, because once it loses that, I mean, the flows will stay in, but you can't query for anything. You have to physically go there and look at stuff, which we didn't run into that problem because we built it that way right out of the gate. But think about the extrapolation of the control plane, right? It's not in the box anymore. And so that continuity has to be there. For you to be able to truly manage the network. So that's a data point that may get overlooked. I think those are probably the big ones to me. Keep it simple, you know, to start with. Don't try to do a bunch of overly complicated things if it's new. I mean, most of this is just standard practice, good practice stuff, you know. Don't overcomplicate it until you really know how it works.
So start with something extremely simple like static flows and then work from there.
Absolutely. I mean, because then you have your proof of concept and then your production proof of concept, and then you can start to add it. And, you know, and I've always found, and I'm not sure how you feel about this, but I've always found that I never really truly trust something until I see it break, because then I know exactly what to expect when it does. And so, you know, in my lab work that I do, building it to work is never the goal, right? That's a step towards the goal of building it to work, then breaking it, watching it break, and then seeing what it feels like to fix it. Then I know what to expect, and then I can trust it, right? And I want to break things in as many ways as I can, because that way, when it happens in the real world, I'll understand what it takes to fix
I could only wish that more people would be like you.
it. Well, you know.
And on this note, let's wrap this up. Where can I learn more about this project of yours? Is it published somewhere on the net? Have you described the experience somewhere?
So there's going to be a couple of things. I think I'm going to probably write an ACM paper to submit for next year. That'll be, you know, the academic focused experience of this, and I'll probably do. I haven't actually written a whole lot of this up yet. I have notes, but you know, I'll probably do a couple of blog posts about, you know, experiences and gotchas of, you know, things to think about building an OpenFlow Signal network on my website, forwardingplane.net. And then I'm hoping that I can maybe give a talk or two at NANOG or something like that about the experience of doing it.
Oh, can I give you a hint?
Sure.
There's RIPE event in Copenhagen in May.
Okay.
This would be a
What's it
perfect
called?
talk.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm up for that. I mean, I'm gonna write a talk. It's just a question of where I give it. I'm happy to give it more than one venue as well, because I think it's important to sort of think about these things from, the engineer on the street kind of perspective, rather than, the developer or the academic or the other school of thought. Having it come from somebody who's been in the networking field and actually done it and watched production traffic run over it and had to support it, if it broke, that's something that we are severely lacking out there, which is one of the big reasons I wanted to do it.
So if someone wants to replicate what you did, can they get the source code?
Most of the stuff is off the shelf. The switches were off the shelf switches. The controller was vanilla Open Daylight Lithium running on a Dell server. It wasn't even a VM, it was a bare metal server. Our lab was a VM and it worked fine, so that shouldn't be an issue. The CLI, I believe, the ODL CLI, I believe, is going to be open sourced at some point. May actually be on GitHub already, I'm not sure. But I'm pretty sure that that's going to get open sourced. And the static flow building tools are sort of proprietary to the conference, and they really wouldn't be useful to anybody because they rely on a custom database on the back end.
Okay.
But yeah, for the most part, 9 out of 10 things are, pretty standard off-the-shelf stuff.
Perfect. Thank you. So, how can people get in touch with you if they want to ask you additional questions, for example?
Sure. So I'm usually on Twitter at Baralio. I'm not always terribly fast to respond to things, but I do always respond. And my blog is www.forwardingplane.net, and my email, I can be found at Baralio@forwardingplane.net.
Perfect.
Same caveats apply about slow to respond sometimes, but I always do.
Oh yeah, that's what I tell people all the time. I'm on the road half of the time, so yeah, I'll respond in 6 months, but I always respond.
Yep, that's how I am. I mean, I have a day job and I have a family, and so it's people get
I know how that feels.
it. Yep.
Nick, thank you very much for your time. This has been really enlightening.
Hey, thank you.
And it's so nice to see someone actually doing this stuff in production and getting some production experience instead of PowerPoint experience.
That was my goal. So thanks a lot for the opportunity.
Oh,
And
thank
I
you.
always enjoy our chats.
So do I. And guys, if you are still listening and you want to know more about SDN, you can go to sdn.ipspace.net where you'll find all sorts of SDN resources. From free webinars to training, workshops, blog posts, and podcasts like this one. So just go over there and start exploring. By the way, if you like this podcast, there are like 50 more like it. Go and listen to them. You'll find them at podcast.ipspace.net. And don't forget to go to iTunes and rate it. Do give us a 5-star, obviously, because otherwise other people won't be able to find it as easily as they would otherwise. And do keep in mind, we call it software defined, but as you've heard today, it actually runs on hardware.
True.